few voters had ever heard. Incredibly, it was non-committal. Instead of saying why she opposed trade deals, Hillary explained the conditions under which she could support them. Sanders's basic assertion, everywhere he went, was simple. I'm against trade. She's for it. That resonated. Hillary believed that if she just had time to give her new bargain message oxygen, to promote it on the air and through a union-driven ground operation, she could steal some Sanders voters. She was offering a solution, she believed, not just anti-trade rhetoric. But while Hillary talked about impenetrable corporate tax policy, Bernie's campaign circulated video of her extolling the virtues of trade in India in 2012. She couldn't have made it any easier for him to draw a contrast on the issue that mattered most to Michigan voters, Democrats, persuadable independents, and a good number of Republicans. With the margins so close, Hillary was going to have to rely on her team's ability to identify voters and get them to the polls. But Mook had staffed the state thinly. And as he was starting to discover, television ads were having less influence on voters than earned and social media. That was particularly true if, as was the case with Hillary's ads in Michigan, they weren't aimed in the right direction. The candidate was hands-on with the advertising plan, reviewing pitches, watching spots, knocking down certain ideas, and even suggesting which markets would get the best bang for the buck. Her instincts were off. The trade angle that Bernie took paid off, said one of Hillary's aides. For decades, people have been running against trade in Michigan. The fact that her out-of-the-gate conversation wasn't as strong as Bernie's made it hard. Bill Clinton didn't need polling or analytics to know this race was going to turn on a knife's edge. He'd been hearing all the concerns and complaints that had seeped through to Hillary, but hadn't convinced her to change direction. When he arrived to campaign for her the day after her speech at the manufacturing plant, he used a much more human bellwether to judge how things were going. As Dingell would later tell friends, Bill took one look at her and drew a conclusion. She had met him to campaign in her district, and she knew that part of her mission was to avoid getting him all riled up. Brooklyn had heard enough of Bill's second-guessing and didn't need the local congresswoman giving him more ammunition. So she kept her mouth shut. But Bill could see the pending disaster in her blue eyes and drawn lips. "Do you think I can't read your face?" he asked. The former president wasn't the only one who felt apprehensive as primary day approached. Neera Tanden emailed Podesta to ask how things were going. He replied on Sunday, March 6th, 2 days before voters went to the polls. "Should get a squeaker win, but he can still get past us," he replied. That view informed the way Hillary's press team suddenly tried to lower expectations. She was leading, but far from comfortable. Too late, she and her team began to hedge on the importance of Michigan. Mook started to argue internally that she should spend primary day in the Deep South and put more emphasis on the same-day Mississippi primary, where she would clean up. But all eyes were already on Michigan, and Hillary believed she could take it. At that point, anything short of a clear victory would be seen as a resuscitating upset for Bernie. The shape of the race, a prolonged brawl or a foregone conclusion, would be formed by the winner in Michigan. Looking to deal Bernie a mortal blow, Hillary took a desperate stab at undermining his core narrative 2 nights before the primary. For most of the campaign, she'd shied away from taking direct shots at Sanders. The unspoken rule, if she could find a policy on which Bernie differed from the Democratic base, she could go a little negative. Standing on a debate stage in Flint and casting aside her practiced caution about negativity, Hillary sensed an opening to go after him hard. "I voted to save the auto industry," she said, with just a hint in her eyes of the roundhouse she was about to throw. "He voted against the money that ended up saving the auto industry. I think that is a pretty big difference." No one was more stunned to hear this than Sanders, who had supported federal money for Detroit's carmakers during the 2008 financial meltdown. Hillary was hanging her claim on Sanders' vote against the $700 billion bailout of the financial industry, which ended up being a source of money that went to the auto industry. Fact checkers called Clinton out, and for Sanders' supporters, the charge was emblematic of three things: Clinton's willingness to say anything to win, her negativity, and her desperation in Michigan. It's hard to know how many votes moved in one direction or another based on that single moment on stage. But it's safe to say she didn't boost her position much. For the long term, she may have helped cement her negatives in the minds of impressionable Michigan voters. The night before the primary, Mook called Hillary to update her on the state of the race. "It's going to be very close, but I'm feeling more optimistic," he said. "I think it's more likely that you'll win than lose." He was hedging in the probability talk of a data guy. But Mook also raised the idea of sending her to Mississippi instead of Michigan to ensure she had victory as her backdrop. That was a non-starter, but Mook would later kick himself for not being more strident. "I should have laid down the hammer," he thought. On primary day, Kriegel sent word that the final analytics showed Hillary winning by 6 points, 49% to 43%. His numbers relied on the assumption that African Americans would account for 20% of the vote, white men would break 56% to 36% for Bernie, and white women would favor Hillary 52% to 42%. Just like Bill, Podesta wasn't sold on the numbers. "Wish us luck," he told a friend that afternoon, "tighter than public polls indicate." At the same time, Bernie was riding in a car with his top aides, Jeff Weaver and Tad Devine. "I think you've done an incredible job," Devine told his candidate, "but I think we're going to come up a little short." Weaver was a little more bullish. The way he saw it, Bernie was surging like he had in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada. The numbers weren't exactly there heading into primary day, but it wouldn't take much overperformance to nail down the state and put Hillary on her heels. Weaver certainly didn't want to be wrong if Bernie pulled it out. He offered up a wide range of possibilities. Bernie could lose by as many as 9 points, he said, or win by as many as 2 points. Bernie liked what he heard. He knew he was connecting with supporters by the thousands on college campuses and in mid-sized cities. He would be mildly surprised, but not entirely shocked, if he had closed the deal in the final days. Still, he was the underdog, and even Weaver's rosier scenario suggested he was more likely to lose than win. He didn't need to stick around for that. He boarded a flight for Miami. Bernie would come to rue that decision later that night. Huddled around a television set in his no-frills South Florida hotel room about 1,300 miles from Michigan, Bernie, his family, and his top aides watched as Wolverine State voters breathed a new burst of life into the campaign. "If we had really believed we could have done it, we would not have gone to Florida," one Sanders ally said. "We would have stayed in Michigan and tried to make a much bigger statement about what the hell went on." As it turned out, Kriegel had been spot on in projecting African-American turnout. It accounted for a hair more than the 20% he'd predicted. But he was way off on how white voters would split between Hillary and Bernie. White men went a little harder for Bernie, 62% to 37%. But the big surprise, one that got little, if any, public or internal mention given its significance, was that she lost white women. Bernie beat her 51% to 47% in that demographic, according to exit polls. Also important for the general election, Bernie won independents who voted in the Democratic primary 71% to 28%. Overall, Hillary lost the state narrowly, 49.8% to 48.3%. Sanders netted just 4 delegates, far smaller than the 26-delegate victory she won by taking Mississippi with nearly 83% of the vote that night. But in the media, the loss in Michigan played exactly how she and her aides had feared. For Sanders, the Democratic Socialist from Vermont running an insurgent campaign on Clinton's left, the Michigan victory will bring a new energy after several weeks in which his chances had seemed to fade, David Farenthold wrote in the Washington Post, pointing to Sanders's 2-1 loss among black voters as a sign that his message on racial justice and police brutality had paid off. That, of course, wasn't the real story, at least not the one that would matter going forward. What had really happened was that Hillary had become disconnected from her 2008 base. She'd alienated white working and middle-class Democrats, but she still didn't know what to do about it. In an instant, Sanders was Lazarus. The Michigan primary was the moment when Hillary finally lost all patience with the leadership of her campaign. The failure and what it would bring from the media and her allies consumed her. All of the aspects of the campaign had come up short. The flaws that donors and friends had complained to her about were all exposed by Michigan voters. She'd checked in with Mook about not spending more money on a field operation and been told not to worry. He had had it under control. She'd complained to her communications team that her economic messaging sucked, and they'd told her to keep repeating it. But the problem wasn't the way she was selling her economic plan. It was that the voters didn't like her stance on the issue that mattered most to them. Some big staff changes had been in the works for a while, and the Michigan loss accelerated their implementation. Mook knew he was on the firing line and desperately tried to salvage his job. He turned to Chief Administrative Officer Charlie Baker, Podesta, and Minion Moore, a veteran political organizer and close Hillary confidant, for help, perhaps forgetting that he'd tried to minimize their influence earlier in the campaign. He even made it clear to others that he was willing to get rid of Marshall, his close friend and top lieutenant, in order to save his own skin, as one colleague put it. But as much as Hillary was ready to reset her lineup, she still didn't want to suggest to the press and the public that her campaign was in chaos. She wanted to make the right moves with the least noise possible, and the crush of primaries meant that she had to wait for a lull to fully execute the changes. There would be no sharp and obvious shift in direction. Chief strategist Joel Benenson was among the first in her sights. It was bad enough that he wasn't proving himself as a strategist in her mind. Worse still, he fought back against Hillary and treated the people around him as though they were just plain dumb. Joel basically alienated himself from everyone because of his personality, said one Clinton advisor. He has no filter. I don't want him doing my stuff, Hillary had told confidants. We've got to have another structure. Amanda Renteria, the political director, was also on a hot seat. She was the highest-ranking Latina on the campaign, a good surrogate, and a strong fundraising draw, but she had clashed with Mook over his allocation of campaign resources. In a familiar refrain from their State Department days, Hillary told Sullivan she wanted him to take over. "You're going to be my traffic cop and my rabbi," she told Sullivan, adding that he would be her de facto chief strategist. His purview would include political strategy, policy, messaging, and debate prep. Halfway through the campaign, Sullivan, who worried that he wasn't the right person to do political strategy, became the official Hillary whisperer. Benenson, who had a $1 million win bonus in his contract, was being informally demoted. But he wouldn't be fired, either. Instead, his role reduction was a secret, kept inside the most elite offices of the Brooklyn headquarters, and many of the people in the second tier of the campaign and below never knew about it. "He has almost no role, but they wouldn't fire him," one high-ranking Hillary aide said in May 2016. "We didn't want any press. We don't want anyone to know about it." It wasn't just Benenson. Mook and Podesta had conspired to sideline all three of the main consultants, including the exceptionally well-liked Jim Margolis and the still close to Hillary Mandy Grunwald. The three of them ended up being reassigned to managing the program for the convention. The kneecapping of several aides, which wouldn't fully take shape for a few more weeks, didn't mean Hillary intended to let the rest of her staff off easy. She was ripshit over the confluence of calamities in Michigan. Her senior aides and advisors all got reamed. She even made an example of Sullivan the day after the Michigan primary. By then, Hillary had transitioned mostly from shock to anger. She had noticed a few other things about the Michigan debacle on her own. Her economic message seemed to resonate when she met with voters, but it hadn't gotten enough lift to get her past Sanders. It was the right forward-looking message about a plan for job growth, or a good enough message, anyway, but it wasn't getting enough oxygen, she thought. She was also pissed that the media narrative out of that primary night was about the Michigan loss and all but ignored the fact that she'd beaten the living hell out of Sanders in Mississippi. In the high-value 2nd Congressional District, he'd failed to get the 15% of the vote needed to earn a single delegate. Why hadn't her comms team prepared the media for Mississippi? The Delta primary earned little more than a line in stories about Bernie's supposed comeback, even though it loomed much larger in the delegate math. Most important, though, she felt like she might have beaten Sanders if she hadn't shortchanged her field operation. After all, she'd only lost by a point and a half. Maybe for the relatively low cost of a couple of 20-something field operatives, she could have won the state and prevented the Democratic hand-wringing and media second-guessing that was now coming her way. She'd signed off on the plans, but they were Mook's, and he was on the hot seat. "Did we run an aggressive enough ground game to go over the edge?" she asked on one call. Hillary forced her aides to think about their failure. Some of the questions, like the ones about her ground game, were clearly rhetorical. She almost dared them to answer back. This series of calls and face-to-face talks was reminiscent of a conference call she'd run after her devastating loss in Iowa in 2008. That time, she'd bullied her aides in the same marmish way and then hung up on them in disgust. But now she also saw an opportunity to push her team to learn from its mistakes. There was a point to her scolding. Get it right and do it fast. In 1 week, she'd be on the ballot again in Ohio, Missouri, Illinois, North Carolina, and Florida. She'd win North Carolina and Florida, she knew, and pile up delegates in those two states. But now Ohio and Missouri, both with big working-class white contingents, and Illinois, where Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, a Clinton invention, had mishandled police-involved shootings, were in play. And with Trump whipping white working-class voters into a frenzy across the country, Hillary knew that she had to solve her problem with them before the general election. These primaries would be a test run, a chance for her to hone her message and ground game in swing states before then. On one call, Renteria, the political director, saw an opportunity to push back against Mook's tight budgets in the upcoming states. For her, part of the lesson of Michigan was that Hillary's economic message didn't have time to sink in with the electorate. She also needed more people on the ground to organize and turn out voters earlier in the remaining primary states. The come-late, spend-little mantra that had worked on Super Tuesday had failed her in Michigan. Back then, there was really just one race on the map close enough for a field operation to make a difference in determining which candidate would win. Trying that same strategy in Michigan was hard, because it wasn't long enough, especially when you don't have something to tap into, said one Clinton aide. For Clinton, that would have meant linking up with the politically muscular United Automobile Workers in Michigan, an existing network that could deploy volunteers and voters on the ground. But the UAW, whose members were more aligned with Bernie than Hillary, sat on its hands during the primary, depriving Hillary of the kind of institutional support that could have delivered votes and likely a victory without her having to spend money on campaign workers. What Renteria didn't know is that while she could damage Mook, she wasn't helping herself. She'd soon be demoted, without a change in title, too. One of the lessons Mook and his allies took from Michigan was that Hillary was better off not getting into an all-out war with her opponent in states where non-college-educated whites could be the decisive demographic. In Michigan, they believed, Hillary's hard campaigning had called attention to an election that many would-be voters weren't paying attention to, and given Bernie a chance to show that his economic message was more in line with their views. So Mook's clique looked at the elevation of the Michigan primary, poking the sleeping bear of the white working class, as a mistake that shouldn't be repeated. That was a takeaway that we tried to use in the general, said one high-ranking campaign official. The old-school, instinct-driven set drew a different lesson from Michigan. The campaign wasn't making good use of Democrats like Dingell, who could tap into their own political networks across the states. One of the corners Mook had cut was choosing not to place a political director in each state, relying instead on Renteria at the national level to hold things together. The state directors, a level above the political director position on most campaigns, jumped from location to location as needed, and often didn't have ties to the political network in the states where they were organizing. That was in large part a byproduct of the emphasis the campaign had put on early states, particularly Iowa, at the expense of paying attention to the rest of the country. The ad hoc political organizing left a lot of people who wanted to help Hillary and had the skills and networks to do it, feeling like they weren't being deployed effectively by the campaign. But after Michigan, their frustration was hitting home with the candidate. Over and over again, the Clinton World veterans, including Bill and Hillary, heard that there was no infrastructure in the states and that no one had been empowered to start building ground operations. In the early stages of the campaign, the old Clinton hands told nervous Democrats that if the campaign didn't keep its focus on the early states, the later ones wouldn't matter. But even as they sought to comfort, they knew there was a problem. "Why are we not using these resources?" Hillary asked. She turned to old friends Charlie Baker and Craig Smith to solve the problem. While Mook would send more paid staff into the states after Michigan, Hillary would also activate the networks of her allies. Smith, a University of Arkansas grad, was the first person hired on Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign and went on to serve as political director in Bill's White House. When Clinton World had needed an adult to supervise the Ready for Hillary operation, Smith took on the task from his Fort Lauderdale home. His Ozark drawl seemed out of place in South Florida, but it was music to Bill's ears. As much as anyone in Clinton World, he shared the big dog's old-school political sensibilities. The two men spoke often, and Smith had been well aware of, and complicit in articulating, the concerns that the campaign had failed to build political units. Baker, too, had been hearing the frustrations of Clinton supporters who were racked with concern over the campaign's lack of a presence in their states. He had helped Hillary map out her campaign long before it launched, and wasn't as much rattled by the noise of Democrats complaining about staffing as he was interested in taking advantage of untapped resources. Baker's activation of a political network in his own home state, Massachusetts, had helped deliver the only competitive contest on Super Tuesday. After a quarter of a century of playing the political game at the national level, the Clintons had political allies waiting to be engaged all over the country. Each of them had their own networks to mobilize. It was a no-brainer to get those folks involved, he thought. For Hillary, it meant having a more trusted, more seasoned set of friends doing her politics at the state level. And it meant she didn't have to pay for top-flight talent. Many were longtime Clinton allies who would donate their time, their networks, and their skills. He and Smith, collaborating with Marshall, set to work on putting together a list of senior friends of the Clintons in each state who could play the role of political overseers. They hammered out a roster of people who had both personal connections to Hillary and knowledge of the political class in the states. Folks like Teresa Vilmaine in Wisconsin and Tamara Lozzato, a longtime Hillary Senate chief of staff who knew West Virginia's political community thoroughly from her time as an aide to Senator Jay Rockefeller. Mike Stratton, a Colorado-based strategist, was dispatched to New Mexico, where he'd run Democratic presidential campaigns for Bill Clinton and Al Gore. These friends of Hillary would operate above the state-level campaign infrastructure and report back to Brooklyn. The idea was to make sure that trusted allies could tap their own political networks and act as a check on the polling, the data analytics, and the field operations. The campaign dubbed the senior political operatives in the states Ubers, and those who moved to other states, traveling Ubers. One source familiar with the initiative called them a second set of eyes and ears. They weren't a formal part of the campaign, they were drafted into volunteering, but rather a shadow political operation and early warning system. This deployment of outside black ops teams mirrored the way Hillary managed other areas of her campaign. It was reminiscent of the speechwriting construct in which Dan Schwerin was the chief wordsmith, but dealt with a coterie of outside scribes who had deeper ties to Hillary and more experience writing at the presidential level. Before the Uber system was developed, inexperienced aides were trying in vain to quickly organize political networks. People were coming in 3 weeks out from a primary, another source familiar with the program said. It's hard to figure out who the players are. We gave them these more seasoned operatives. They'd done it before. If the fix worked, it would boost the political operation and cut down on complaints from officials and allies who thought there weren't enough savvy staffers on the ground to run a proper campaign. The activation of key political leadership outside the campaign wasn't just a de facto demotion for Renteria, but also part of a broader rebuke of Mook. The state teams under the control of Marshall, his top lieutenant, would now be shadowed by veteran operatives with closer ties to the Clintons. Mook had been so focused on the main task at hand, winning delegates without spending too much money, that he had lost sight of the optics and the politics. For weeks, Hillary had been trying to impress on him the importance of finding a sweet spot that honored the delegate-driven strategy without allowing bad storylines to fester. Within the Democratic Party, the perception was that Hillary wasn't putting enough people into primary states, and the media story was that Bernie's ground troops were evidence that he had more support in state after state, even when she won. There was concern. The narrative was not good, said one of her most senior advisors. If you look at the narrative versus the results spoke for themselves. What Hillary wanted to know was, how do we make sure we don't enhance the narrative? All of the issues she identified were intertwined, but some were more real. She wasn't effectively communicating her economic message to voters. White men were moving away from her, and there weren't enough ground troops to support her in some states. And others were based in the skewed perceptions of Democratic elites and the media. Having spent a dozen years at the highest levels of an administration, as First Lady under her husband and as Secretary of State under Obama, Hillary knew better than most of the people around her that both reality and perception could destroy her. And she knew that in order to sell her policies to the American public, from the campaign trail or the White House, she had to master both the policy and how to sell it. That was a hard-won lesson for Hillary. She'd been humiliated after she'd failed to get buy-in for her health care plan in 1993 and 1994, not just from the public, but even from Democratic senators on Capitol Hill. Her messaging had been terrible then, and her political outreach had been even worse. And in 2008, she'd been convinced that Democratic voters would choose her experience and policy acumen over what she saw as Barack Obama's cheap sloganeering. But it didn't matter how much she'd mastered the details of policy or how many times she'd been in political and policy meetings at the White House, she failed to sell herself as someone who could bring about the things Obama promised. For decades, she'd worked so damn hard to address her deficiencies as both a policymaker and a politician. There were still rough edges on her, some of which sat in places she couldn't see, like her blindness to conflicts of interest, her own preference for reality over political optics, her paranoia about political opponents, and her love of the dollar. She was committed to addressing her own weaknesses as a politician, but she didn't always know how. She needed her lieutenants to do it. Or, she thought, she needed to find new lieutenants. It wasn't enough to get most things right most of the time and dismiss failures. This was the time for honing her operation, for the rest of the primary, the general election, and, she hoped, the presidency. Soon she would install Minion Moore as a power in Brooklyn. Mook could never figure out exactly what Moore's job was, which should have been a good indication of her influence with Hillary. If the campaign manager didn't know why she had been placed in his midst, it was at the behest of the candidate. Between Sullivan's taking authority for strategy and Moore's keeping an eye on Mook, Hillary had quietly deputized a new leadership team. Mook would remain in charge of the day-to-day operations of organizing in the states, but his role would look less like that of a campaign manager by the end of March. The Clintons didn't think he could handle the whole job he'd been given, but they didn't want to push him from the upper ranks of the campaign. He had value, they believed, and his plans had put her in position to win the nomination. Robbie was never bad enough at a crucial enough moment to warrant a dismissal, said one senior aide. If they had made a decision to remove him, said another. He would have been removed. Chapter 12. Damage. In the aftermath of Hillary's New Hampshire debacle several weeks earlier, when white working-class voters ran up the score in Bernie's favor, John Podesta offered Robbie Mook an insight that should have sent a chill up the young campaign manager's spine. There's more chance that Jeff Weaver, the top Sanders aide, is going to be running a campaign that's ahead on March 15th than you are, Podesta said. Mook, who already knew his job was in jeopardy, had husbanded the campaign's money, to the frustration of operatives in the states, but knew that donors would stop writing checks if Hillary fell behind, or was even seen as floundering when the results of the five-state mini-Super Tuesday elections came in on the Ides. He knew he'd get fired, or layered over, if she wasn't on a clear path to the nomination at that point. Behind the scenes, Hillary was already reining him in, but her fate and his reputation were on the line as voters in Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Illinois, and Missouri prepared to go to the polls. To his credit and his detriment, Mook was able to tune out the negativity of people around him and keep his focus on the task at hand rather than his job status. Podesta, the pessimist, was in a funereal mood on one conference call about the states, but Mook, despite his precarious position, was more optimistic. "Guys, it's pretty likely that we'll win at least three of these states, probably even four," he said. "We're not going to win Missouri," he thought, "but we're more likely to win four of five than get zero, one, or two of them." From Mook's perspective, Hillary was already ahead of the conservative scenario he'd drawn up in 2015. He'd planned for losing Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada before winning in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday and March 15th. But he also knew by this point that if she'd lost Iowa and Nevada, he'd have already been fired or layered over. Heading into March 15th, he was confident that Hillary's delegate lead would hold or expand. And in his mind, that was pretty much all that mattered. Former Obama campaign manager David Plouffe was in Mook's ear, too. He had told the campaign manager to ignore the noise of the Clintons and their coterie of outside advisors and just stick to his plan. Mook firmly believed that thinking too much about his own situation would lead him to run the campaign the wrong way and to spend too much time on internal politics. He was determined not to make what he thought were poor strategic decisions in the service of saving his own hide. So Mook focused on the data and the delegates, and Podesta worried about the narrative and the potential for the race to go sideways if Bernie got a big boost. The bar for Bernie was low. If he won one or two of the states, it would look like he was building off his Michigan upset. That was particularly true because Ohio, Illinois, and Missouri were all Midwestern industrial states with significant white working-class populations, and they all held primaries, the type of election that was supposed to favor Hillary. After Michigan, she needed to deal Bernie a major blow to restore confidence in her own campaign and prevent him from picking up momentum. Her lead in the national polls was widening ever so slightly. On a more granular level, she had big leads in Florida and North Carolina, where minority voters would constitute a major share of the electorate, but the margins were just holding steady. More troubling, Bernie was gaining on her in Ohio, Illinois, and Missouri. Despite temporary spirit lifters in Nevada, South Carolina, and the Super Tuesday states, Hillary was still stuck in a rut, running between frustrated and forlorn, and those closest to her knew it. On the night of March 11th, just before she flew to St. Louis for a campaign rally, a special visitor to her plane tried to improve her mood and help her come up with a plan of action. She was aboard her plane at the Peoria International Airport, going over her remarks on criminal justice issues, when a figure with a puff of white hair, ruddy cheeks, and a toothy smile burst into the cabin. "I figured it out," Bill Clinton exclaimed, his blue eyes flashing with excitement. "Trump can build his wall, and we can open up slot machines along the wall, and the proceeds from the slots can pay for the wall and maybe could send people to college, too." Hillary beamed, laughing and clapping her hands as her husband sketched the preposterous caricature of a way to one-up Trump. But there was a more serious point behind the quip. They both knew Hillary was failing to connect with non-college-educated whites. It was the reason they had decided to meet together on the tarmac before they went their separate ways. Hillary's inability to break through with these voters had been apparent in New Hampshire, in Michigan, and in the industrial states they had campaigned in that had yet to hold elections. The problem was most pronounced in coal country, including parts of Ohio, Illinois, and Missouri, where voters were listening to Bernie in the Democratic primary and Trump on the Republican side. People were struggling to get ahead economically. They hadn't recovered from the financial crisis, and jobs that had traditionally sustained their part of the country had been disappearing for decades. "They feel like they're forgotten," Bill said. Sitting on a couch, as Hillary stood with her palms resting on the tops of two captain's chairs, Bill went through her stump speech, making recommendations. They believed her policy solutions were the right ones to modernize these industrial economies for the long haul, but Hillary hadn't yet connected the dots effectively. She had to explain why the turn-back-the-clock promises of politicians like Sanders and Trump were empty, and why voters' anger had to be converted into a commitment to policies that would bring their communities into the future. It was a bank shot compared to a vow to end trade and resurrect coal jobs. Bill was a much better explainer than Hillary, but she had to do something to bridge the distance between what these voters thought they wanted and what Hillary believed would be best for them. By the time Hillary took off for St. Louis that night, Bill had provided some much-needed energy and levity. "She was clearly uplifted," said a person who was on the plane. More important, he'd given a thorough distillation of where her stump speech was missing the mark. When she arrived at the Nelson Mulligan Carpenters Training Center the next day, Hillary made a Bill-style acknowledgement of the validity of voters' anger. "You have every right to be angry, but anger is not a plan," she said. "You have every right to vent your frustration about the way that our economy and our political system is failing, but venting is not a solution." Then she laid out her economic strategy. It was better, more tailored to the working-class whites in Missouri, Illinois, and Ohio, the industrial states voting on March 15th, than a lot of her previous rhetoric on the trail. And the message couldn't have been delivered at a better time. The same day as the St. Louis trip, and 3 days before the primary, Elon Kriegel sent the candidate an update on the state of the race in each of the primaries. Hillary was going to cruise in Florida, where she held a 59% to 29% lead, and she had a comfortable margin in North Carolina at 51% to 37%. But in just a few days' time, her 10-point lead in Ohio had been cut in half. She had gone from up a point or two in Missouri to down a point, and her advantage in Illinois had narrowed from 8 points to 6 points. All over the map, she was losing ground among white voters. Yet again, Bernie seemed positioned to turn a narrow victory in a big state into fuel for his revolution to continue. Hillary was going to extend her lead in delegates, but could she finally stick a fork in Bernie's campaign? On election night, she quickly racked up wins in Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio. Despite the shifting momentum in Ohio, she won comfortably by 14 points, by running up the score with African Americans and taking the white vote 53% to 47%. Bernie won white men, a continuing source of consternation to Hillary, 57% to 42%, while 61% of white women went with her. With Illinois and Missouri still outstanding, and her aides still concerned that they could tip in Bernie's direction, Hillary took the stage a little bit before 9 p.m. in a West Palm Beach, Florida convention center, and not only declared victory, but tried to use the three-state run to pivot away from Sanders and toward Donald Trump. A few hours earlier, around 5 p.m., she'd phoned Dan Schwerin in Brooklyn. She didn't like the draft of the victory speech she was looking at. It was focused on her contrasts with Sanders, as Podesta and Sullivan had wanted. They didn't like the optics of dismissing Sanders and his supporters. But Mook had been pressing behind the scenes for her to rhetorically turn the page on Bernie and start lining up for the general election. This wasn't just another primary day. It was the moment that any honest appraiser of the race would say Bernie had no chance to win the nomination. Hillary took his side. "This is a big night," she told Schwerin. "This sounds like every speech I've ever heard. What's new? What can I say?" She wanted something that felt like she was speaking to Trump, but could also be seen as a contrast with Bernie. Schwerin had been through the last-minute act before. So, knowing Hillary's lawyerly affinity for numbering her points, he scrambled to put together a framework with three tests for the commander-in-chief that could be applied to both Sanders and Trump. He fired off the new draft about an hour later, and they kept tweaking it right up until she took the stage. Amid the string of victories at a seemingly critical moment, Clinton seized an opening to declare victory. The underlying message in her speech that night was clear. She wanted the public to believe the Democratic primary had just come to a close and she was on to the general. And she wanted that to happen without her explicitly saying Bernie had lost. "Our next president has to be ready to face three big tests," she said. "First, can you make positive differences in people's lives? Second, can you keep us safe? Third, can you bring our country together again?" She hit Trump directly, too. "When we hear a candidate for president call for rounding up 12 million immigrants," Clinton railed, "banning all Muslims from entering the United States, when he embraces torture, that doesn't make him strong. It makes him wrong." Trump had just thumped his Republican rivals that night, highlighting his powerful performance with a rout of Florida Senator Marco Rubio in Rubio's own home state. Trump's victory knocked Rubio, the best hope of the establishment wing of the GOP, out of the race. With each passing primary day, it was getting harder and harder to see paths for candidates other than Trump to win the nomination, and Hillary wanted to start throwing jabs in what she believed would be a heavyweight fight with Trump for the presidency. When she was done blasting the Donald, Hillary hustled to the airport for a flight back to New York. Now she just had to hope that the results in Illinois and Missouri didn't make her pivot speech look presumptuous. She didn't know the exact delegate count as her motorcade moved toward the landing strip, but Florida, Ohio, and North Carolina would end up netting her 100 pledged delegates. If Sanders got really lucky in the remaining two states, he might be able to pick up 10 or 15 delegates. She'd hammered him, and yet a loss in either Missouri or Illinois would provide tinder for a Bernie comeback tale, especially with a series of states that favored him looming on the calendar over the next several weeks. "We thought we would surely lose Missouri, maybe Illinois," one Hillary advisor said. As her pilot prepared for takeoff, Hillary got a quick burst of good news. She was going to win Illinois. There was an understated symbolic importance to that. It was Hillary's native state, and a place she'd been crushed by Obama in 2008. 4 out of 5 was good, but she wanted a sweep. She was tired, both from the grueling primary campaign that was supposed to have been a cakewalk, and from having to pretend that this was a real race against Sanders. Hillary settled into a seat next to Mook and Huma Abedin and lazily listened to updates on the numbers that were still trickling in. Then the exhaustion overtook her. She closed her eyes and dozed off. Over the years of traveling from state to state and country to country, Hillary had developed the uncommon ability to fall asleep anytime she wanted, no matter what else might be going on around her. But her staff remained anxious about Missouri, too edgy to use the 2-plus-hour flight to recharge. Mook and Marshall had a lot riding on a sweep. They were sick of being second-guessed. Michigan notwithstanding, their plans were working just fine, they believed. Hillary already had a delegate lead that Sanders couldn't touch without a catastrophic shift in the dynamics of the Democratic electorate, say, an indictment of Hillary over the email scandal. Even that might not be enough for him. But Michigan had reinforced all of Hillary's concerns about the thin staffing on the ground. And Bill had been beside himself. The night before the primaries, he came padding down a hallway, yelling the name of his chief of staff, Tina Flournoy. He'd been talking to Joyce Abusi, a veteran Democratic operative in Missouri, and she'd given him an earful about how Brooklyn had rejected her requests for more staff and more money. If things turned sour, it wasn't her fault, she argued. Bill was riled up. But for Hillary, it was no longer just about being on the path to victory. She was infuriated by the way Sanders had made his attacks against her personal and about her character. His focus now was fully directed at portraying her as a corrupted creature of elitist circles in Washington and on Wall Street, a perpetrator of the sins of the powerful against the powerless. And she was irritated by Sanders' ability to command media attention for pulling off Pyrrhic victories. Each time that happened, it meant she was another set of primaries away from turning her attention to the general election. Hillary was stuck fighting a zombie candidate who could embarrass her and undermine her but not defeat her for the nomination. She wanted to square up with Trump in earnest, not just in rhetoric carefully designed to guard against a backlash from Bernie and his voters. But to do that, she'd have to convince everyone that Sanders had no shot. That, in turn, meant she had to beat him badly on March 15th. Even then, she might not be able to shake him. From the Clintons' perspective, Mook and Marshall had failed to put organizers on the ground. The communications team wasn't getting the message right, and Bennison's attitude was the only thing worse, they thought, than the strategic advice he gave. Even the vaunted analytics team couldn't predict turnout as precisely as she would have liked. The pitch-perfect component was the delegate plan mapped out by Jeff Berman, who had counted the all-important noses for the nomination of Barack Obama in 2008. Mook and Marshall had their own tried-and-true method of dealing with the Clintons' frustrations. They'd do just enough to make it look like they were taking instructions to heart. That's why, after Super Tuesday, they'd hired just a handful of staff in the 5 March 15th states. No matter how furious Hillary was after being humiliated in Michigan, neither Mook nor Marshall thought it wise to flood the zone in the upcoming states with paid staff. They were the professionals, and Clinton world was full of backseat drivers who didn't understand modern campaigning. Their strategy risked further enraging Hillary if she lost a state she thought she would win, but they were confident in the merits of their plan. Now, with 4 of the 5 states in their pocket, Clinton's young strategists were one state away from silencing their critics, or so they hoped. Missouri, they knew, held outsized importance in the power jockeying that constantly raged behind the scenes in Clinton world. It would be harder for others to second-guess them if Hillary cruised through mini-Super Tuesday unblemished. As her jet made its way over Long Island Sound, descending toward White Plains, Marshall's phone service kicked back in. He called Abusi on the ground in Missouri. With 99% of the precincts reporting, Hillary held a razor-thin lead. The conversation had been going on for 3 or 4 minutes when Abusi told Marshall to hold on for a second. "I think the last precinct's in," she told him. Marshall urged his fellow passengers to quiet down. With the plane moments from touching down, a groggy Hillary awoke to the minor commotion he caused by shushing his colleagues. Marshall put his phone on speaker, and Abusi's voice boomed across the cabin. "Oh my fucking God," she shrieked. "We just won the fucking state of Missouri." Hillary and her aides erupted as the plane touched down. She smiled, high-fived Mook, and clapped along with the rest of the jubilant crew. "Oh my goodness," Hillary said. That was an understatement. This mini Super Tuesday in the shadow of the Michigan loss, and with 3 Midwestern industrial states voting, held so much portent for the rest of the Democratic contest, and perhaps for Hillary's ability to compete for white working-class votes in the general election. "We weren't talking about Michigan on the plane," one Hillary aide said of the 7-day-old ghost that had all but reserved a seat. "But a lot changed in just a matter of a week." She'd just knocked Sanders out. She knew it. He knew it. Or at least he should have. And so did Mook and Marshall. As the plane taxied, the Clinton team popped a bottle of champagne, a more celebratory drink than the leftover bottle of some previous jet-setter's scotch that Marshall had discovered squirreled away behind a seat earlier in the campaign. Back at the Brooklyn headquarters, in the dead of night, someone handed brooms to Mook and Marshall. Sweep, sweep, sweep. They were cult heroes for the hundreds of campaign staffers removed from the elite level of the operation. But the 5-0 drubbing Hillary delivered to Sanders shouldn't have been such a nail-biter, internal critics and some of Hillary's closest friends griped. The margins should never have been that close. A little extra money and a few more staffers placed in the states earlier in the campaign would have rendered Sanders incapable of contesting states like Illinois and Missouri, these naysayers believed. Victory was covering up the deficiencies in Mook's strategy and tactics, they thought. "Hillary won because of Hillary, not because of her staff," one of them insisted. Hillary, it turned out, was thinking exactly the same thing. In the days after the March 15th primaries, Marshall gathered 2 dozen or so members of his staff at the Brooklyn headquarters. He needed to tell the campaign's organizers that he and Mook and Hillary had heard the complaints about having too few people on the ground in primary states. In truth, that was a source of tension between Hillary and Mook. She wanted more resources campaigning in theater. But for Marshall, this meeting was an appeasement mission. The organizing unit had taken the brunt of the criticism for Hillary's losses and near misses, and he took a stab at accountability. "We fucked up," he said. In Marshall's mind, it wasn't a true admission of failure on the part of the campaign leadership, but he had to sell it that way to convince his audience. "We didn't have people in the states. Huge mistake." What Marshall knew all too well was that Hillary was about to go through her worst stretch of the campaign from the perspective of losing states and yielding delegates to Sanders. It wouldn't be enough to put Sanders in contention, but it would knock her off stride. Mook tried to prepare Hillary for the coming rough patch. "We're going to lose all of these," he told her. "It's going to feel awful." From his viewpoint, Hillary could look at the delegate math and see that she wasn't in danger of losing the nomination. But no candidate likes to be humiliated, whether she's expecting it or not. More complicated was the challenge with the junior staff, who were going to have to suffer through the pain of losing, the second-guessing of the Democratic donors and elected officials, sharp-bladed media, and the possibility of more infighting. And they'd have to come out the other side ready to do battle in the remaining primaries and in the general election. "Robbie's learned his lesson now," Marshall said, subtly elbowing his boss and close friend, which suggested to those in the room that he wanted people to believe he'd stopped greedily slurping Mook's Kool-Aid. "We've got a lot of work to do," he added. "We're going to be different moving forward." He was more right than anyone at this meeting would ever know. Hillary was hearing all of the second-guessing about her campaign manager, and she did plenty of it herself. He seemed so confident about his way of doing things, always ready with an answer to her questions. But he was good at managing up, and she worried that she was sliding by on too thin margins in many of the primary states. By keeping him in the campaign manager post, where he'd continued to control the budget and the vote-building operations, she betrayed a lack of confidence in her own political instincts after the 2008 loss. One friend explained Hillary's reluctance to sack Mook this way. David Plouffe and David Axelrod, Obama's successful campaign gurus, believed she was the problem, not her campaign manager. That was in Hillary's head. If someone was wrong, she thought, it might be her. That paralyzed her a little bit, the friend said. Still, by the middle of March, she had all but stopped talking to Mook directly. By then, Mook was in all but open warfare with Podesta. For starters, their vastly different styles clashed time and again. Mook, with his field organizing roots and millennial viewpoints, was part manager, part dreamer, part salesman, and part cheerleader. Podesta was more grounded, direct, and pessimistic. He was also furious at Mook for cutting him out of the information loop on major parts of the campaign, including budgets, analytics data, and staffing in the states. It's not that Podesta believed modern campaign tools were useless. He trusted that they had value. He just didn't trust Mook. When Abbasi had called Bill to raise the alarm that she wasn't getting enough resources from Brooklyn, Podesta told Bill's chief of staff, Tina Flournoy, that Abbasi was in charge, according to Robbie. "In charge?" Flournoy asked incredulously. "As in, she was the state director?" "That's what he led me to believe," Podesta replied. Abbasi wasn't officially the state director, and both Podesta and Flournoy seemed to be at a loss as to why the person in charge of the state would get Bill riled up about a possible loss. The younger man's campaign projections were always rosy, no matter the topic. Fundraising, organizing volunteers, getting votes. He aimed to please. But he also closely guarded the truth. Since the very beginning of the campaign, Podesta had watched as Mook tried to neutralize potential power rivals, Jen O'Malley Dillon, Adam Parkamenko, and Charlie Baker among them. Together, they'd boxed out the consultants. But after two stints as a top White House official, Podesta had little patience for playing games with Mook. The clash had created an environment in which it was impossible for even relatively high-ranking campaign operatives to get a feel for who was making decisions. Robbie felt like, "I'm the campaign manager, I'm supposed to run a campaign." And John felt like, "I'm the chairman, I'm supposed to be in charge," one top aide said. By late March, the slow shift of power away from Mook became semi-formalized with the creation of a new brain trust. All decisions would now flow through a 6-person team. Mook, Podesta, Huma Abedin, Jake Sullivan, Jennifer Palmieri, and Minion Moore rounded out an executive council known by a variety of nicknames, the most positive of which was the Super Six. It operated as a board of directors. Podesta and Mook, who had frequently rendered decisions without consulting each other, retained the titles of chairman and campaign manager, respectively. Abedin had control of Hillary's schedule and traveled with the candidate. Palmieri, who had endeared herself to Hillary and would ultimately take on a traveling chief of staff role, was in charge of the sprawling communications department. Sullivan oversaw just about everything else. And Moore was a powerful minister without a portfolio. Hillary charged them with making decisions by committee. Sullivan, the policy chief, and the only one of his generation rising at a time when Hillary was turning to old hands, ran the Super Six meetings. He declined an offer for a bump in title, as he was given ever greater jurisdiction. That decision was a sign of his savvy in not making waves any bigger than he had to, internally or externally. He also knew that he was a square peg in a round hole. Hillary had asked him to take on a role that was outside his wheelhouse because she trusted him. Throughout the campaign and after it, Hillary's other aides spoke of Sullivan in reverent terms. Abedin remained Hillary's shadow, a translator and gatekeeper whose influence could never be overestimated. Often blamed unfairly when she rendered decisions that had actually been made by Hillary, Abedin had graduated from her long-time post as Clinton's body woman, the aide physically closest to her at all times, and carried the title of vice chairwoman. But no one had greater metaphorical proximity to the candidate. Moore, who cut her teeth in politics as an aide to Jesse Jackson, and who had been the White House political director in the Bill Clinton administration, had a leg up on everyone in Brooklyn. Not only did she know electoral politics, but she knew Hillary as well as anyone. Moore was a one-woman Hillary tribe. In fact, Hillary had been pressing her to come aboard the campaign for months, and Moore had finally relented